Bonjour à tous. Aujourd'hui, nous avons le plaisir d'accueillir Kevin Vegeter, à qui je vais poser, j'ai le grand, très grand honneur de poser quelques questions. Alors, Kevin, vous êtes né en 1950 à Los Angeles, vous êtes écrivain de SF. Vous avez écrit plus d'une vingtaine de romans, parmi lesquels Dr. Adair, sur lequel nous reviendrons, Madlands, Noir, Machine Infernale, et tout récemment encore Fiendish. Alors, Fiendish Sins, qu'on pourrait traduire mal par complot diabolique, paru en 2013, j'espère d'apprendre qu'il sera traduit bien et distribué en France. Vous avez également écrit un certain nombre de romans dans les univers de Star Wars, Star Trek et Blade Runner, et vous terminez actuellement une série, les Kim Ho Thriller, qui est paru en numérique dans votre langue natale. Et je vais commencer tout de suite par les questions. Nous n'avons pas la traduction apparemment. Donc Kevin n'a pas la moindre idée de ce que je lui ai dit, ce qui est un peu embêtant. On prend un autre casque peut-être. On essaie encore. Est-ce qu'ils m'entendent ? Moi, j'entends un canal, mais je n'en... On ne vous entend pas, messieurs du Goethe Institute.
We have a French to English translation.
Yes, we have. Est-ce que vous pourriez nous dire quelque chose dans les casques, si vous avez... Oh, my English is so bad, Kevin, I can't. I just can't. Ça va venir ?
I hear it, but I don't hear a translation.
Ah.
Okay.
Maybe it's connected with
it. Oh, there we
go. Great, great. Yes, I know. Alors, je ne sais pas sur quel canal je suis. Donc, il faut me le traduire hein, quand même, hein, lui. C'est bon? Alors, nous allons aborder... Je vous ai présenté, Kevin.
Yes, I can hear the translation.
Je vous ai présenté à nos spectateurs, Kevin. Donc, vous connaissez, je pense que ce n'est pas très utile que je répète. Mais en revanche, nous allons passer tout de suite aux questions qui s'articulent en quatre points. Votre œuvre en général, d'un point de vue littéraire, les personnages, votre façon de vous brancher avec votre imaginaire... Votre travail dans les licences Star Wars, Star Trek et Blade Runner, évidemment, passage obligé, le steampunk, et ensuite, comment dire, Dr. Adair, la vie, l'univers, le futur et le reste. Et ce sera la fin de notre interview à ce moment-là.
That's good.
Alors, vous avez très souvent utilisé la ville des anges comme décor dans votre œuvre, au point d'en faire pour moi, lectrice, un personnage à part entière, mais de votre côté, celui de l'écrivain, quelle place lui accordez-vous dans votre imaginaire ? Est-ce que l'influence du noir et du hard-boiled y est pour quelque chose ?
Yeah, that's a pretty valid observation. The city of Los Angeles has always been sort of the dream city, the city of my deep consciousness. Are we good? Yes? Because I grew up not in Los Angeles, but outside of it. Are we good? Okay. And so Los Angeles was always this sort of city of longing for me, and a city that I knew something about, but did not know it as deeply as I wanted to. So as I grew older and as I imagined and thought about Los Angeles, it became, you know, sort of my Emerald City, my city of longing, my city of imagination. And at the same time, I had sort of a historical background to Los Angeles because of my family, before I was born, coming to the area as sort of economic migrants from other parts of the United States. And so it was always this sort of dream landscape for me. And you see that, I think, in my books, where in something like my horror novel, In the Land of the Dead, it goes very far back, relatively, in the history of Los Angeles. It goes back to the Great Depression. And then we go all the way forward to books of mine like Madlands, where it depicts and imagines a future imaginary Los Angeles. So in some ways, to think of the city of Los Angeles as a character, even if it's not speaking the way a character does or walking around the way a character does, it's always that constant influence, like the weather or the way people think about things.
Et si on établit un parallèle avec vos personnages, pardon. Et si on établit un parallèle avec vos personnages en quête ou en refus du père, je vais recommencer parce que je pense que Kevin n'a pas entendu. Et si on établit un parallèle avec vos personnages en quête ou en refus du père, Los Angeles serait-elle la mère dévorante cachée? Et par une extension tout à fait équilibriste de ma part, sachant que votre toute dernière série de romans met une héroïne en scène, la série Kim Ho, quelle est la place que vous accordez aux femmes en général dans votre œuvre? Ça fait deux questions en une.
Yeah, the notion of the landscape that people move through and how that influences the characters. I think with some of what I've been doing just recently with what I call the Kim Ho thrillers, it's really the first time that I've dealt with a female protagonist and also dealt with a female protagonist in the first person. And it's one of those experiences that on the surface seems quite odd. There's tremendous differences between me and this character, Kim Ho. She's female, she's much younger than I am, comes from a different cultural background on the surface. She's Korean-American. But she sees herself not as Korean-American, but what she talks about as feral American, in the sense that because of being an orphan and growing up in very difficult circumstances, she's never had the experience of wisdom and even just advice from previous generations being passed down to her. And so she's constantly faced with the dilemma of having to figure everything out on her own. And at some point she realizes that her situation is the same as everybody else's now, where there is no transmission of inherited wisdom and advice coming down from generation to generation. Everybody is pretty much a feral, self-taught, self-realized person, for good or bad. It's a handicap in the sense that you have to figure out how to do things. It's a blessing in the sense that you're not limited by what you've been told on how to do things. So she can actually develop herself as sort of a freelance assassin in a way that she might not have been able to in previous environments. And in that sense, It took me a long time to come up with a character like this, my entire writing career, but she is the character that most reflects my inner life, that when she talks and reacts, she talks and reacts very close to the way I talk and react, and people who know me, my wife and my friends, say, really, when she does things in the books and she says things, I can hear you. They can hear KW talking and reacting. And so in that sense, this is a tremendous realization of how freeing it is to deal with characters that are not close to you, are not similar to you, but reflect something deep. You're seeing a common bond between yourself and a person of a very different nature. And the landscape she moves through, even though she's not limited to Los Angeles, it's very much that landscape of a person that I felt myself as a child to be, trying to figure out my position in the world. And it just worked out that way. And it was one of those things that writers are very familiar with, this phenomenon of a character coming into a writer's head fully formed and without any consideration about developing the character bit by bit. Most of the time, writers, you know, work on sort of a creational basis where they bit by bit by bit build up the character that they need for a particular story. Every once in a while, you get this sort of blessing where a character just comes into your head talking and speaking and writing or talking and speaking and acting the way she does, and there's just no changing it. I thought, well, maybe I'm making a mistake by pursuing this character and writing stories about this character because she's so unlike me. And people will say, well, where do you get the right to talk about the world and the things that happen in it from the viewpoint of a Korean-American female? And so I tried. I tried changing the character. I tried changing her from male to female, from female to male, or tried changing her ethnic background. And she just stubbornly refused to change. She just said, no, this is the way I am. You have to write about me this way. And in that sense, that's one of these things that common experience for writers, not that it happens all the time, but it does happen once in a while, where the character just appears fully formed and you have to deal with her that way.
Voilà qui m'amène directement à ma deuxième question. Vos héros, à part Kim Ho, sont bien souvent de jeunes gens ignorants ou en butte avec un vécu difficile, un environnement hostile, qu'ils connaissent peu, par exemple, je pense à Dr. Adair, le père ayant disparu ou laissé un héritage lourd, comme dans Infernal Device. Alors, quelle est la place du héros dans votre œuvre ? Est-il un archétype porteur de votre propos, un témoin, autre chose ?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to see, say, the protagonist of my first novel, Dr. Adair, as sort of being a first step on the chain of characters that very similar characters keep popping up. The person of the character who has to live and operate and act and deal with dangers and hostile environment, but without a received wisdom. Essentially, my characters are all orphans in some way, and writers tend to gravitate towards stories about orphans because, for one thing, we all tend to think of ourselves as orphans. We all tend to think of ourselves as not having received everything we need to get on in this world, and a story about an orphan very often resonates in a deep way with readers because they see themselves as orphans. But the writers themselves also see themselves as orphans. And so very many of my characters operate that way. They're in a hostile environment and they don't have the basic tools to operate, to get forward. And the conflict and the action of the story, it revolves around their just trying to find those means and feeling a certain sense of resentment that other people have these tools ready to hand and they don't. And so there's a constant sense of comparing yourself to other people. But I think this is more normal than not, that is how we deal with the world and how we feel ourselves dealing with the world. And in that sense, it's both an oppressive environment, but also a liberating environment. Whatever problems my characters have about finding their place in the world, they at least have the freedom to do so. They are not locked into it. And in that sense, these are very anarchist-like novels. They are not novels about somebody working their way up through a system. And in that sense, they're very diametrically opposed to, say, the great bulk of literature, some of which is magnificent, that deals with, in science fiction, with the military and scientific organizations. My characters would be totally lost in the military or totally lost in a scientific organization. They just can't fit in. They don't have what it takes. So none of the stories ever revolve about organizations so much as they revolve around the outsider who, if he or she has any contact with an organization, it's always sort of a hostile relationship.
À propos d'hostilité, la technologie, qu'elle soit steampunk ou non, est aussi l'un des grands invariants de votre œuvre. Elle est souvent invasive, intrusive, séductrice aussi. Mais de votre point de vue, vous la percevez comment, en fait?
You know, we touched upon this in the panel that just sort of immediately preceded us, and it's interesting because we are, you know, the theme of our conference here at Utopiales is artificial intelligence, and we're seeing the development of artificial intelligence in a way that now that it's finally coming about, or we're seeing the first stages of it, it's very different from how we imagined our contacts, our dealings with artificial intelligence were going to be before it actually came around. We had the notion that there were going to be these horrible, violent monstrosities chasing us and trying to kill us, like in the movie Terminator. And we're really not seeing that. My perception is that we're not seeing that kind of artificial intelligence, that kind of hostile intelligence. Or if we are seeing it, it expresses its hostility towards us in a different way that is in somewhat masked or hidden. We're actually seeing artificial intelligence and robots and this interface with our lives as we lead our lives, where the robots and the artificial intelligence are not horrific and monstrous and violent, but they're actually very friendly seeming and very cuddly seeming, and they seem like pets and friends, and or at least they're designed in such a way to make us think that they're our friends and they're cuddly and are want to do good things for us, but actually that design of our interface between our lives and robots and artificial intelligence is very much a masquerade. These things have a commercial or political purpose, which is not necessarily what is best for us, but they have the ability to masquerade as wanting what's best for us. And this is a little bit sinister, and I don't think we, as science fiction writers and readers, really anticipated that to the degree that we're seeing. We thought that robots and artificial intelligence were going to be much more obviously we could recognize that they weren't our friends. And it's going to take a lot more critical thinking on our parts to get through the mask, the design, the apparent friendliness of robots and artificial intelligence, to be able to discern what they really want from us and what their designers really want from us. And so in that sense, I think, you know, we're just starting to see the beginnings of the true way in which artificial intelligence and robots and technology is going to be designed and implemented. And I have the feeling we're not going to be ready for it. We had more of a built-in capability of dealing with the Terminator than we are with cute, friendly robots. The way we evolved as a species, we have a fight or flight response built in, hardwired into us, so that if we see something big and dangerous and violent, we know how to react. We either fight it or we run away from it. Things that do not have our best in, do not really want to do things well for us, but are designed to look as if they are our friends, we may not be able to cope with that as easily. We are more likely to be fooled and manipulated by cuddly robots than by big, tall Terminators who want to kill us. And so we're going to have to, like I said, kind of dial up our game in terms of looking at the intelligences and the technology that we deal with. And it may be that we're seeing a healthy response in people who are saying, you know, I think I've had enough Facebook for today. I think I've had enough Twitter for today. I think I'm just going to shut everything down and I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to deal with human beings. I don't want to deal with the digital world anymore. I'm a little sick and bored with it. And so people are, you know, that may be a healthy response. And it's a response that in the past we've criticized. We've said, oh, this is a person who's afraid of technology. He or she is afraid of being torn out of the world that they were comfortable with, and they're afraid of the new world that technology is bringing. And actually, we may have to really ask ourselves, is it fear or discomfort that provokes these responses in us, or is it a much healthier and more self-regarding response to say, no, technology is good, it does good things, but maybe there's a limit to what it can do for us, and there's a limit to how much we should be involved with it. I really think of, you know, something like my own father, who you know, I knew obviously very well. He was an excellent craftsman. He was a wonderful carpenter. He could do anything with the tools that he knew how to use. But when he used the tools, he used them, and then he put them away. And he did not walk around as a carpenter with a cross-cut saw looking for something to build. So in that sense, it makes me wonder that the ubiquity of technology, that it's constantly on and linked and connected to us so that we're constantly walking around wired, whether that's a good thing or not. And maybe we need to start thinking about, okay, let's take a holiday. Let's take the tools, close them up, turn them off, set them on the shelf, and not out of fear or discomfort, but out of our love for the world and for our fellow human beings, just do more things without technology.
Il y a encore plein de choses qu'on peut faire sans la technologie. Alors, Parlons un peu de votre travail pour les licences Star Wars, Star Trek et Blade Runner. Se glisser dans l'univers d'un autre auteur afin de faire revivre, prolonger ou offrir un hommage même modeste à son œuvre peut s'avérer une expérience troublante et instructive à la fois. Mais les univers Star Wars, Star Trek et Blade Runner sont presque tout autre chose, même si à l'origine, ils peuvent être issus de la vision d'un créateur comme Lucas ou comme Dick. Ils sont devenus avant tout des univers collectifs, quasiment réinventés et réamendés à chaque nouvel opus. Que ressentez-vous en tant qu'écrivain lorsque vous vous appropriez un univers collectif de ce genre ?
That's a very interesting question, and because you know I do keep a divide in my head between you know the books that are entirely out of my thinking and writing, and I don't have to be concerned about something else. When you get invited or hired to work in another person's universe, those aren't private universes that you get invited into. Those are universes that have become public universes. I mean, you are not dealing with things that nobody else knows about. If you're hired to write books in the Star Trek or Star Wars universe or even the Blade Runner universe, it's because those things have grown out of their public nature or their private nature and have grown into a public nature. Everybody knows so much about Star Wars and Star Trek and within the science fiction community about Phil Dick's Blade Runner world that I can make references to something, Jedi Knights or Luke Skywalker or Starship Enterprise, and I don't have to explain what those are. When you're writing in a private universe, you're constantly having to provide this kind of background. And in that sense, writing about a public universe, I don't have to explain about the elements that you know I've been hired to work with any more than I have to explain that there's a country called France and its capital is Paris. I mean, if I set a book in France, you know, I'm pretty sure that people will know that there is such a place. And they will know that there is such a place as Paris and that sort of thing. Same way with Star Trek, Star Wars. I can say there's these things, tractor beams maybe, whatever, or the swords and things like that. And people have already seen those just as if they existed in reality. In that sense, it's this strange thing where I can talk about things that don't exist and people react to them as if they do exist. And that's kind of interesting that I can talk about these things and people go, oh, yeah, I know who that is. I know where that is. I know what those things are. And in that sense, as long as you stay consistent with those things and you don't make them different from what people already publicly know about them, it's very relaxing. You don't have to worry about this big background and explaining what things are the way you do with private universes that come out of just your own head. And it can be relaxing, it can be liberating, but at the same time there's a tension because since it's public, people, the fans, the readers of those universes are very proprietary towards them. And it's very easy, if you're not careful, to say or do something or write something in a book based upon those universes that people react very strongly to. And interestingly, you often come across a little sort of gaps and holes in these universes. I remember when I was first hired to write something for Star Trek, and they said writing Star Trek novels has become a big business, so much so that we have an entire floor of our building at Paramount Productions, which is just to answer questions for people who are writing these books. If you have a question about anything to do with the Star Trek universe, you dial this number and you say, okay, is Jean-Luc Picard left-handed or right-handed? And they'll say, okay, he's right-handed. Okay, great. And they'll assure you. They say, whatever question you have, don't worry about asking that question. Every question has been asked before. We've got all the answers. Don't worry about it. Ask whatever you want. There's no way you can come up with a question that we won't be able to answer. I thought, great. And so I started writing the book, and I came up with a question that I needed answered. And I called the number, and I got the head person. And I said, okay, I need to know for this book, on the Starship Enterprise, when's payday? And they said, when's payday? And I said, yeah, when do people get paid? I mean, essentially, these people are like, you know, cruising around on a ship. Every once in a while, they must get paid so they can go ashore or on planet and, you know, do something, buy something, go to dinner, whatever. And they said, congratulations, Mr. Jeter. You have asked the one question that nobody has ever asked before. Nobody has ever asked before, when's payday in the Star Trek universe? And I don't know if they've ever answered the question yet. So it's one of those things where, you know, I guess I come from a sort of political background where I'm always thinking about economic issues, and I'm always thinking about, you know, how people get by in the world. And in that sense, in terms of getting paid, Star Trek is sort of a universe where that's not really such an issue. And people do things for other reasons than besides getting paid.
Remettez vos oreilles. Et pour Blade Runner plus particulièrement, est-ce que le fait que cet univers appartienne à celui d'un ami change la donne quant à votre implication, on va dire, imaginaire et affective?
Yeah, the Blade Runner books that I did were kind of a special consideration in that notion of going from private to public, in the sense that the Blade Runner universe is not as fully developed as, say, Star Trek and Star Wars. There's been so many Star Wars, so many Star Trek books, the movies and everything like that. And so those are very public. The Blade Runner thing, you know, you're really dealing with very limited source material. There's, you know, Philip K. Dick's original novel, and then Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And then there's, of course, the movie Blade Runner that is based somewhat upon the book. Tremendous contradictions between Phil Dick's novel and the movie that was based upon it. And there, you know, it was done in such a way by Ridley Scott, the director of the movie, and his screenwriters, and everybody who worked on the movie. They said, look, when we're making this movie, we're not going to be totally concerned with being completely faithful to the original novel. And so when I was approached by the Phil Dick estate to write, you know, a couple of novels, you know, that somehow dealt with Blade Runner and the Phil Dick novel, I said, look, if you're trying to make this a whole consistent piece, it's impossible. There are such contradictions between Phil Dick's novel and the movie that they are completely irreconcilable. And as long as you're okay with me doing these books in such a way that it is not going to be a completely successful remarriage of the book and the movies, and it's going to be this crazy hybrid, are you okay with that? And basically, Phil Dick's estate, you know, his adult children said, yeah, you know, that sounds kind of like what we would want our dad would have wanted us to do. And so, in that sense, the Blade Runner books, it's very easy for people to look at them and say, this part in your book lines up with the movie, but doesn't line up with Phil Dick's novel. Or they can say, this part lines up with Phil Dick's novel, but doesn't line up with the movie. And so in that sense, it's kind of this blurry shifting back in and out of focus. Sometimes the books I wrote gravitated towards the Phil Dick novel. Other times they shifted towards the movie. And in that sense, it's kind of a very much different experience, especially writing it, compared to the Star Trek and the Star Wars universes, where things are essentially consistent from top to bottom and from side to side. In that sense, there will never be a novel by anybody, me or anyone else, if that ever happens, that can completely successfully combine Phil Dick's novel and Ridley Scott's movie, or whatever, they're talking about the sequels coming out now to the movie. Those sequels cannot reconcile these gaps either. And so that was a strange experience, but in some ways one that I very much enjoyed. And as long as you're not completely fixed upon things being totally consistent throughout and all the points lining up, then it's I think an enjoyable one.
Alors, nous allons passer à l'aspect steampunk de la force. On vous considère avec vos amis Blaylock et Powers comme les pères du genre steampunk. Mais vous avez souligné ici ou là qu'il s'agissait surtout d'une grosse blague. Morlock Knight est donc considéré comme votre première œuvre steampunk. Si les références de science-fiction habituelles y sont bien présentes, et d'abord bien sûr Wells, j'ai envie de vous demander quelles sont les œuvres victoriennes dont il est possible que vous soyez inspiré. Et pas forcément littéraire, d'ailleurs, il se peut que vous ayez eu accès à des essais ou des études, enfin, je ne sais pas. On a dit, il me semble que vous y aviez des accents de Conan Doyle, mais Dickens, Wilkie Collins, ont-ils coloré votre travail ou d'autres qui ne me viennent pas à l'esprit?
Yeah, that's a question that I love being asked. Because we tend to have a viewpoint of Victorian literature based upon what has come down to us as the big names, the Charles Dickens, the Wilkie Collins, and shading off into the Edwardian age, H.G. Wells, and of course Jules Verne. These writers. These are the big names, and so those are the names that people are generally going to be familiar with. What, to me, was fascinating about Victorian literature and why I loved it so much were the not-so-big names and the completely forgotten names. Victorian literature, I mean, also included a lot of really trashy pulp fiction of its type and of its time. And there were these writers in the Victorian age who were essentially the pulp writers of their time. And probably the one that I became the most interested in was a fellow named Harrison Ainsworth. Harrison Ainsworth was a monster of productivity. He wrote at a pace that's virtually impossible to imagine. And he wrote these huge, big, thick thriller novels. And he was sort of like the Stephen King of Victorian literature, and they were thrilling novels and exciting, and people read them for excitement and adventure. And probably the one that is, if anybody reads it anymore, a novel called Rookwood, which includes a very famous action scene revolving around the notorious highwayman Dick Turpin, who to escape the authorities rides from London to York overnight. It's a thrilling action scene. He's pursued the whole way, and it's just the legend is that Ainsworth wrote it in the same amount of time it took for the character Dick Turpin to actually make that ride. That's how fast that Ainsworth could write. But he was just this crazy pulp writer. And it's a lot easier now to find his books than it was back when I first started trying to find them. I really had to dig through old, musty libraries and, you know, decaying stacks of books to find these novels. Now you can pretty much find all of Harrison Ainsworth's books on the Gutenberg Project, at least in English, but some translations too. So that's one of those things where technology has opened up this vast archive that would otherwise be forgotten. And so somebody like Harrison Ainsworth, like I said, I kind of was more attracted to him because he was a thriller writer. He was a pulp writer. He was this action writer, and really he wanted to do nothing more than write thrilling action adventure stories, and he was very successful doing it. And then you have other writers. I mean, the writer who really gets the Victorian writer who gets very much criticized. Lord Bulwer Lytton. You have this notion that Bulwer Lytton, he was very successful back in the Victorian days, but now he's thought of, he has a reputation as being the worst writer who ever wrote, at least in the English language. And they have this competition at a university in California where people try to write badly and they get an award based, and says Bulwer Lytton on it. And it's really unfair. Bulwer Lytton was quite a good writer. He came up with phrases that we constantly use nowadays, and they've entered the language. He was the one who coined the phrase, the pen is mightier than the sword. Every time people say the pen is mightier than the sword, they're quoting Bulwer Lytton. And he wrote a lot of just wonderful books, and In that sense, it was sort of a contrarian streak in me and Tim Powers and Jim Blaylock. We were all at university together. We would read these books that nobody else read and admire these books that nobody else read. And just in that sense, we'd say, oh, well, Charles Dickens, bleh. Who cares about Charles Dickens? You should read Harrison Ainsworth. You should read Bulwer Lytton. And in that sense, we were just being kind of snotty punks about the whole thing, to the degree that you can be sort of have a punk attitude about Victorian literature. So those, it was these obscure Victorian writers, I think, who inspired us more than the big names. And because, the obscure writers were the ones, who didn't aspire to anything greater than telling thrilling stories. And so for people like myself and Tim and Jim, that kind of attracted us more than the big names that we should have been reading, according to our professors.
Alors, on va s'occuper un petit peu de Dr. Adair, la vie, l'univers, le reste. Dr. Adair, qui ressort pour les Utopiales, aux éditions ActuSF, là. Il s'agit de votre premier roman, il me semble, publié, si je ne me trompe pas, écrit 10 ans avant sa première parution. Et vous y avez écrit quelque chose que je vais dire en français et que les gens du Goethe Institute vont faire ce qu'ils peuvent pour vous redonner le texte à peu près. Toute ma vie, j'ai voulu que le monde entier ait besoin de moi, vienne vers moi, me supplie. Même, m'adore. Et j'étais presque arrivée. Et je voulais juste ça, juste pour. Parce que je m'imaginais que si j'y parvenais, je pourrais dire à tout le monde, en même temps, à Los Angeles, à Orange County, au monde entier, d'aller se faire foutre. Vous avez toujours envie de ça, monsieur Jeter?
That's a real young man's attitude. It actually took 12 years from writing the book to being able to get it published. And I was talking about this with the ActuSF people the other day, where I said, I so envy younger writers who are starting their careers now, because they're starting their careers now in an environment that whatever happens, they can start finding their readers and their audience immediately. There's never going to be a 12-year gap between somebody writing a book and finding a way to start getting it out to the readers. Because of online distribution, the e-book thing, the independent e-publishing thing that's possible now for writers, new writers are never going to have that same experience that I did of writing something and then spending years trying to find a way to get it out to people. And if they want to tell people to fuck off, they can do it immediately. They won't have to wait 12 years. Whatever they want to do, they'll be able to do it. And we are just in the very, very first days of what is going to be possible for writers and readers and communities of enthusiasts. We're only beginning to see what this is going to mean, not only in terms of getting the books and the stories out to the people who want them, but the actual nature of those books and stories is going to change in a way that we cannot even imagine, but we're just barely beginning to see what is possible. There are going to be new formats and new types of stories and new types of books based upon this ability to write and publish in a non-curated, non-gatekeeper world. This will be the first time in the history of writing that you are not, writers and readers are not going to have to communicate with each other through a narrow channel. They are going to be communicating with each other through an infinitely wide channel. That's going to have good things and bad things associated to it. We are going to have to develop new skills in terms of finding what we're looking for. And search engines are not going to do that for us. Search engines are going to just, you know, direct us towards things that the search engines want us to find. And we are going to have to develop entirely new skills to find the things that we actually want to find. And that's going to be a problem. with the narrow pipeline, you always knew where to look for what you wanted. It was going to be somewhere at the mouth of that pipeline, what was coming out, the books, the stories, the magazines, the movies. It was coming out through a fairly narrow channel. With an infinitely wide channel, you're not going to be able to look as easily. The place where your things that you want to find are appearing is going to be infinitely wide. So even though there's going to be this tremendous freedom, there's also going to be this tremendous difficulty associated with that freedom. And it's going to mean that writers are going to have to make themselves visible to you in a way they never had to before. It was always somebody else's job to take a writer's book or a writer's story and get it to you. Now it's going to be somewhat different. And it's going to require or demand or make possible an enthusiastic response that's going to be much stronger and much more passionate and much more active. And in that sense, we don't know what that world is going to look like. That world, the non-curated, non-gatekeeper a world. And in that sense, yeah, the things that are going to be made possible, really, I see a lot of writers my age and younger who are terrified by this. They are terrified by the freedoms and possibilities that are being presented to us. And they are desperately clinging to this old model that is rapidly breaking apart. Excuse me. And I mean, I've talked to these people, and they've said, if I'm not validated by a curator, if I'm not validated by a gatekeeper, if I don't have a publishing house saying, yes, you've written a book worth publishing, then what am I? I literally had that question asked of me by a writer who said, what am I if I'm not validated? Well, this is a good question. And it's one of those things where really, for somebody like me who's trying to do this amphibian transition from the old world, that old ocean, into this new world, you know, it's a struggle. It's a struggle. It's been a mental struggle for me to look at the possibilities that are available now and say, what do I do now? Always before I knew what to do, I would write the story, I would give it to the publisher, I'd give it to the editor, they would validate it in some way, they would put it in the channel, they got it out to the reader. This new world does not have that comforting restriction. And there's another writer, a friend of mine named Mike Stackpole, who says, and he got into a lot of, you know, politically incorrect trouble for saying this. He said, that is a house slave mentality. You are comfortable with the world in which you were a house slave. You knew how you got fed. You knew where you slept at night. You knew what you had to do. The master told you. Now, in a masterless world, this can be, for a lot of people, a terrifying, limitless world. And in that sense, you know, I look at younger writers and I think, this younger writer, this man, this woman, they're going to operate in a world I would have given anything to have been born into, that I wanted to live in that world, and that I'm trying to at least get a bit of a grasp on that world. But we are going to see new types of writing. We're going to see new types of fiction. The possibilities are tremendous, both for writers and readers, and a combination of the two. And that, I think, is the most exciting thing that has happened in my lifetime, that writers and readers are going to be communicating with each other in a new world, where, and it's going to create new things that we can't even imagine.
Ça me fait tout à fait la transition pour ma dernière, toute dernière question. Vous avez écrit dans Machines Infernales, alors on va vous redonner le texte exact cette fois, parce que je l'ai retrouvé, et ma traduction épouvantable de ce passage. Eh bien, ça va être énorme, ma surescape. Si vous êtes... Alors, pardon, j'ai loupé la première question. La première question, c'est à quoi ressemblera le futur ? Eh bien, ça va être énorme, ma surescape. Si vous êtes dans la technologie, comme moi, vous voudrez être à fond dedans. Les gens vont posséder toutes sortes de merde et réaliser tout ce qu'ils voudront avec. C'est pour cela que ça ne m'a pas surpris une seconde la première fois qu'Olbendray m'a parlé de faire sauter l'univers. Et dans l'avenir, tout le monde ne rêvera que de ça. Alors, à quoi ça ressemblera le futur, Mr. Jeter ? Pas seulement celui des écrivains. À quoi ressemblera le futur ? Pas seulement celui des écrivains.
I have no idea, except that it's going to blow up in a way, not blow up physically in the sense of the world coming to an end, but in terms of seeing new things, we are really in the position of those amphibians who are just barely crawling out of the ocean. We think we know what artificial intelligence is going to be like. We have no idea. We think we know what the internet is going to be like. We have no idea. I mean, we are so much in the early days that we are going to really be spending most of our time blowing up and smashing the world that we live in perceptually and intellectually in ways that we have no idea how the pieces are going to come back together. And that is both terrifying and tremendously exciting. And we'll see. I'm looking forward to it.
Moi aussi. Merci. Merci à vous.